The Giants win the pennant, or David Tyree's helmet catch, the immaculate reception, the Rangers winning the Stanley Cup after 55 years. These are the great moments in sports, right? Well, not if you're a fan of the Dodgers or the Patriots or the Raiders or the Vancouver Canucks. Remember, that was the team the Rangers beat. But in our minds, we see the celebrants. We picture trophies being hoisted. And the loser serves the same function as a very weak, dramatic villain. They're not Iago, but some two-bit thug who stupidly tried to shoot Superman in the chest. Then when you think about what Reggie Miller did in May of 1995, 8 points in less than 9 seconds, you think as much about the victim, which is to say the Knicks. It's weird. Maybe it's because we're New Yorkers, but whenever anyone says, hey, remember when Reggie Miller hit those shots? No one will ever forget who it was against. Dan Clores is a lot of things, and most recently he's the director of a documentary film, still getting some airtime on ESPN and ESPN 2, 3, 4, and 5. Name of the movie is Winning Time. Dan, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much, Mike. Thank you.
In the 90s, where did you stand in terms of Knick fandom?
Surprisingly enough, I was a Pacer fan. I grew up a Knick fan, but when Donnie Walsh took over the Pacers, he's a friend of mine for over 40 years, so I became a Pacer fan. Sitting in the garden with my wife, a Knick fan, surrounded by Knick fans, cheering for Reggie.
But before, with the great Knicks teams of Bradley and Clyde and the championship teams, you loved them as much
totally,
as
totally. I grew up with the Knicks. I remember the day they got to Buescher for Wilt Bellamy and Comeau. I was, you know, the Knicks played the way that every kid in New York played, you know, just unselfishly.
And, you know, I wanted to ask you about that because when the Knicks of the 90s, which were a tough, broad, muscular team, Patrick Ewing and Anthony Mason and Charles Oakley, I mean, just strong guys, it was always said that they reflected the personality of the town. But I kind of wondered about if sometimes teams do, right? The Showtime Lakers did and the Detroit Pistons were blue collar. But do you think those tough, kind of rough around the edges Knicks necessarily were a reflection of New Yorkers or just kind of a good team and the best you could build with the talent you had?
I think they were a reflection of their coach, of Pat Riley. I think that Riley going to the Lakers, that was not the true Riley. Van Gundy says it in the film. Riley was Schenectady, tough, hard-driven, you know, work ethic.
Yeah.
Everyone's an enemy. It's us versus them. When he came to New York, he couldn't replicate Magic, Kareem, Worthy. So he built this team in his image, and that was the emotional image. And then he surrounded that and built it around tough guys. I never liked those Knick teams when I was watching them, but researching the film, I got to appreciate them very, very much, actually.
This is part of a series called 30 for 30. ESPN's been around for 30 years, and they wanted to take 30 signature moments and explore them. It's been a really interesting series on everything from the Larry Holmes, Muhammad Ali fight to the Baltimore Colts marching band. This was among the best in the series. Did you have the idea, because you've done other documentary films, did they come to you with the idea, or did you always want to do this?
Well, I did a film for them called Black Magic, which I was fortunate enough it won the Peabody on the Civil Rights Movement, and they asked me what I'd like to do. So the image, I found a photo that Donnie sent me many years ago of Reggie making a shot in the garden. The fans behind him were in shock, in pain. Originally, I wanted to do a film on that photo, but it was from a 98 game, not from the meat of it, 93, 94, 95. So I zeroed in around four events from those years.
So that original idea would be like Sunday in the Park with George. Starts with the pointless painting, and then everyone comes to life. And who knows, maybe Mandy Patinkin was in the garden at that time in 98 also.
Well, definitely Spike was.
Yeah. We'll get to that in a second because, you know, talking about these series in the 90s, you have to talk about Spike Lee. So I'm sure you came into it saying, here are the moments I have to get to. I have to get to, you know, some of Reggie Miller's amazing games. I have to get when Patrick Ewing yelled and almost knocked down John Starks. What were the ones that you forgot about that, upon reflection, you found to be amazing?
Well, I zeroed in on four moments. The Starks headbutt, Reggie's 25 points in the fourth quarter, which led to the Spike outburst, which made this a front page story all around the nation. Reggie's 8 points in 9 seconds, and then the Ewing finger roll. In researching the film, there were so many great moments, but not as critical as those. In 95, Mason and Charles Smith had a fist fight on the bench during the playoffs. This was a rough team, the Knicks. And, you know, the 2 years before that, Charles Smith missed the layups. The year before that, John Starks went 2-for-18. What I learned was that if you didn't play the game the Riley way, which, and don't take me wrong, the man is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant coach. But if you didn't play the game his way, you didn't play. One of the interesting things I learned was, remember, he never substituted for Starks the year before against Houston, 2-for-18.
Right. Since it was 2-for-18, he just let John Starks gun it in the NBA Finals. They wound up losing that game and therefore losing the series.
But he had Rolando Blackman on the bench, and everyone said, well, maybe he was too old, but he was a great shooter. But Blackman was not a Riley-type player. And psychologically, I think Riley didn't put him in because of that.
Right. And if the question is, did Riley shape, if he assembled a team in his image, did he turn the players tough? The places they got these players from was, I mean, it was a hodgepodge. Ewing, obviously, you know, the most sought after draft pick in NBA history. But then they picked John Starks up bagging groceries, and they get Anthony Mason, who was playing in Turkey, even though he had a storied career here in Springfield Gardens, Queens. So it was really an assemblage of parts that were nasty and brutish.
They were very, very tough. I mean, Ernie Grunfeld did a great job working with Riley and putting that team together. They lacked, both the Knicks and the Pacers lacked one player, so they would have a stronger possibility of defeating Michael Jordan, who of course was out of the league in 94. The Knicks didn't have a point guard who could penetrate and dish, and the Pacers probably didn't have the same thing, actually. They were built in a mirror image of one another. The Knicks,
right,
and the Pacers.
And all through the season, if you remember these seasons, an acquisition would be made by one or the other teams, and people would say, well, that doesn't really make sense. And it was explained, oh, this guy is meant to neutralize that specific guy on the Pacers, or vice versa.
Or the Bulls.
Yeah.
And Donnie Walsh was at the Pacers at the time, and he brilliantly put that puzzle together, as Riley and Ernie did. And the key for Donnie Walsh was Derek McKee. He had two brutes at forwards, Antonio and Dale Davis. He had a great offensive center in Rick Smits. He had Reggie. He had a series of point guards. But Derek McKee was the type of guy that a team needs to win. He does everything unselfishly.
And so we've spoken about Reggie Miller. Let's play a clip. And what we're going to hear here is Reggie Miller talking about... Well, I think what we're going to hear here is Reggie Miller talking about Spike Lee making a claim, and then you cutting exactly to a piece of tape that rebuts Spike Lee's claim. Let's hear that.
He was saying, "You guys stink. You guys are still hicks."
I never ever had any in a play with an athlete before like that ever.
So there is Spike Lee saying, "I've never had interplay with an athlete," and you show him talking to Scottie Pippen and exactly having interplay with an athlete.
Well, I think I made the film as a comedy, to opera, actually. And Spike was great. I mean, you know, when people – Spike is a great comedic director and storyteller. So that's what he's doing here. I mean, and people in New York vilified him for a couple of days because they blamed him for the Knicks loss. And he says in the film, "Thank God we won game 6 in Indiana. It wouldn't have been easy for me to live in New York again."
You know, I think you get Spike maybe better than anyone's gotten him. I know for a time he was just, it's some of his statements, his confrontational statements or movies were the ones that, you know, you want to say white society thought was the real Spike Lee. So they remember Mookie throwing the garbage pail through the window at the end to Do the Right Thing. They forget that was a really funny movie with those three guys on the corner and many other comic elements. Do you think Spike now is more embracing his comic persona, or that we're just coming around to see that this guy has lots of humor to him?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that... when we generalize or stereotype or take one thing out of someone's mouth and form an opinion, it's just as easy to be wrong than right. So all I know is the guy is a great film director, was wonderful in Winning Time, and has that in him. He certainly has all the attributes of a storyteller in him.
This is Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Dan Clores about a documentary, Winning Time, Reggie Miller versus the New York Knicks. What did any reaction from Miller's Pacers teammates in that they weren't mentioned in the title? Would the Davises rather you call it the Indiana Pacers versus the New York Knicks?
I don't think so. I mean, it was Reggie versus the Knicks. I mean, of course it was. Reggie's the showman. That's the point of the film, is that this is not about a basketball player. It's about a performance artist. His stage is the biggest stage in his particular field, Madison Square Garden. It's his Carnegie Hall. It's his Lincoln Center. And, you know, without Reggie, there is no drama. There's just a pretty good basketball team in Indiana. And both teams had a similar history. Neither had won since 1973. Both were terrible throughout the 70s. Both started rebuilding in the 80s. Donnie Walsh led Indiana. He drafted Reggie versus Steve Alford. The Knicks got lucky in the lottery, got Patrick Ewing, and both hired brilliant coaches, Larry Brown, Pat Riley. The stage was set for the early 1990s.
It's funny. There's a lot of guys on the Pacers who would have been great on the Knicks. You know, Larry Brown grew up in Long Beach. Reggie Miller would be, if he was paired with Patrick Ewing, the most beloved Knick ever, because he has such a personality.
There's no question. I mean, New Yorkers hated Reggie. I don't think they hate him anymore, maybe because of the movie, but he would have been the biggest star in New York. He almost Ali-like. I mean, he's... You know, that's the irony of the film. New Yorkers, Midwesterners resent New Yorkers, and New Yorkers resented Reggie Miller. But Reggie Miller's one of us.
That's such a great comparison to Ali, and I didn't realize until you said it, because they're both the very rare athlete who does something amazing and totally understands what he's doing as he's doing it. They're sort of outside themselves as they're in it. And it's rare for an athlete. Athletes usually have myopia, but, you know, the rare ones like Miller and Ali don't.
Well, you know, I think when there's anyone in any field that's so brilliant, that almost verges on genius, they're different than anyone else. And, you know, guys like Bill Russell, Oscar Robertson, Michael Jordan. And then you add an element of brutality to someone like Reggie or Jordan or Kobe or Jerry West or Bird. They'll kill you if they have to.
And I'm speaking with Dan Clores about his killer new documentary, Winning Time, Reggie Miller versus the New York Knicks. It looks back at a series of playoff series in the mid-90s between the Knicks and Pacers. We'll have more after a break. Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Dan Clores about the documentary Winning Time, Reggie Miller versus the New York Knicks. We've talked a lot about and heard a little from Reggie Miller. So what were the Knicks all about? This clip, and we're going to hear their point guard Greg Anthony and then Patrick Ewing, really sums up the Knicks persona of the era. You have that clip?
We would say, hey, we're going to win something tonight. We're either going to win the game or the fight.
Gonna get hit. We might get cheap shotted.
If we knock somebody down, it was a fine to pick them back up.
It's a war, and that's what it was.
It was a fine to use good sportsmanship and pick someone back up. We heard a little of the music. Tell me about the music choices you made in the movie.
It takes place in 93, 95, so I spent a year listening to hip-hop, and I realized this is about a performance artist, and one day just opera hit me, and my editor is very musical, and we just had fun.
Reggie Miller, the performance artist, at one point in the documentary, there was you relay to him that Patrick Ewing got in John Starks, the shooting guard's face, and John Starks' mom told Patrick Ewing, don't you ever do that to my boy again. You relay this to Reggie Miller, and Reggie has a great reaction to that, which is what?
Well, Reggie says, oh, if I would have known that mother stuff, if I would have known that John Starks' mother had called Patrick Ewing,
I don't know if I would have used that on the floor, but if I would have known that. And I asked everyone, you know, Ahmad Rashad, who was terrific in the movie, and all sorts of guys, would Reggie have used that? And he looked at me like I was crazy. Of course he would have used it.
There was nothing off limits. Did you talk about, I don't know if it made it into the film, but how he strategized the trash talk? I read an article with the Jet, Bart Scott, and he does opposition research, essentially, to try to get under
guys' skin.
I don't
think Reggie was a researcher. I think it was all ethereal. He just came after you. But I did ask who was in Reggie's league as a trash talker, and only two names come up: Larry Bird and Michael Jordan.
Right.
But there's a clip in the film early on where Reggie gets to Michael Jordan so bad that Jordan chokes Reggie Miller on the floor. That's a pretty good thing.
You can't get credit for being a great trash talker unless you're a great player, because then you're just a chirpy jerk.
Right, right. And that's what someone says. I mean, Reggie, it wouldn't have mattered if he wasn't so good. It's the same thing with taking a last shot. I mean, he's an assassin, just like a few of the other guys.
So there is Reggie Miller reacting to what you you told him that Patrick Ewing's said about John Stark's mom. This gets to the question of how did you strategize the order of who you would interview? Because if you hadn't found out from Patrick first, you could never have told Reggie.
Well, I don't. The only one I strategized was I wanted to interview about 10 or 12, 15 people before I interviewed Reggie mm-hmm. and his sister Cheryl. And I wanted to interview Pat Riley last because I knew that Riley would be so fantastic that I'd end up spending 4 or 5 hours with him. So I kept it to a half hour. There were 31 people I interviewed. Everyone made the film. It's the first time it's ever happened in six or seven movies. But and everyone went along with it. I walked in. People are amazed about Ewing. Ewing is different than all the stereotypes. Ewing is friendly. He smiles. He's insightful. He's curious. Ewing was the big surprise of the movie.
I heard an interview you did with Bill Simmons, a podcast, and I think you touched on this. New Yorkers have a love-hate relationship with Ewing. Love him for his greatness. Hate him for the fact that he never won us a championship. But Ewing had a really tough upbringing where he came here from Jamaica and had a series of kind of Svengali coaches who always, you know, use the us against the world philosophy. So up until he retired from basketball, is it your assessment he never really had a chance to let anyone in, or did his personality change once he got away from the game?
I think that young athletes mature later stage in life, because they are surrounded and so mesmerized by the figure in their life, the male coach figure. So he had Jarvis, he had John Thompson, he had Pat Riley. Svengali's, I don't know, but set in their ways, us versus them. Yes. So now he has a chance to fully blossom. I mean, he is a child of the islands, coming to a racist environment outside of Boston. So
yeah.
You know,
and they would taunt
out.
Him with chants of Neanderthal, and they would get nastily racist, maybe Absolutely. Even without knowing that they were. But it was very hurtful to him, and he internalized it.
Well, of course. I mean, who wouldn't? But Reggie, the same thing. Reggie, in a different way, endured the chants. But Reggie came from a two-parent home. Reggie came from 5 brothers and sisters. They were, you know, lower middle class, military family. But imagine Reggie comes into Madison Square Garden, all the other arenas, and they're chanting, Cheryl, Cheryl, you know, dogging him because his sister is better player than him.
His sister's probably the greatest. I mean, she's a 3-time National Player of the Year, the only one who's ever won that. So she could be the greatest female basketball player of all time. Did that bother him? Because he loves Cheryl, and he knows she's great.
It didn't, I don't know, bother him, but it certainly affected his emotional makeup, and that's the point of the film. Because who he says later on, with the Knicks, it was Cheryl all over again. He had to prove himself. He grew up in the shadow of all things, a sister. He was second fiddle to the sister. Now he's second fiddle to the New York Knicks.
What did the sister, what did Cheryl, what insights did she give you when you talked to her?
Well, she loves Reggie, but she loves to rag him. I mean, they're like twins. They're only a year apart. But she has great respect for him, but she loved beating him to the ground until her junior year in high school.
whether it's fans getting on a player or other players getting on a player, I always wondered about the wisdom of trash talking. Sometimes it works and you do rattle the opposition, but it seems just as often it motivates the opponent. Do you have any thought on that?
It all depends. I mean, when you're playing and you know a guy's better than you and tougher than you, and then he's going to talk to you, well, then you're completely out of the game. But if you have that self-confidence within yourself, then you're going to use it to motivate yourself. So it's an individual thing.
But Reggie Miller would trash talk because he needed it, not because it would it might rattle the other guy, but if he had to be quiet, it would probably affect his game.
Well, he's a performer, so he's warming up. He says 70% of the time it was to psych myself up. 30% of the time is to get into the opponent's head. Now, he knew who to do it to. Starks, vulnerable, insecure young man, he could do it to him with a big temper. Charles Oakley would have knocked him on the ground.
Starks has a sweetness about him. The word I think about is guilelessness about John Starks. What was your takeaway?
It's a good word, and he absolutely does have a sweetness to him. I mean, he's just a great guy, great person. I mean, look what he's overcome. He wasn't even going to make that Knick team. He was going to be cut, but he got hurt in a game in Golden State that year. And Riley was going to cut him, but you couldn't cut a guy if he was on the injured list. So when he was eligible to come back on, that's when he started to really blossom. I mean, John Starks got every ounce of his ability out of himself. Wonderful player, just not a Reggie Miller.
And in that interview that I said I heard you do with Simmons, you said that there was one regret in presenting the film, and that was someone insulted John Starks' intelligence.
Yeah, you do these things, and then you say, I shouldn't have used that line, or I should have shifted that line. So I think I used someone saying, someone said, boy, your boy is really, really dumb about Starks. And I would have taken that out.
Would you have taken it out because you thought the film can survive making the point without explicitly making it? This was a mental mismatch in all senses of the word between Miller and Starks.
Yes, you lose lines all the way till you lock the film, and it's just one of those lines. But then again, the line about it's Cheryl all over again. If I made the film again, I would have put that in later, not when I did.
And how often does this happen? Do you have a lot of artists regret after your documentaries?
Less and less, more and more films. But I never watch them after I make them. So I just don't, because I don't want to regret.
Well, don't you have to go on like the circuit where you try to go to festivals and maybe promote this
one?
Well,
they all happened before. This film was my fourth film at Sundance. So they happened before the air date, which I think was about a week ago.
How does the one about the historically black colleges, did that air on HBO?
Black Magic. That was also ESPN. That was 4 hours, two parts, no commercial interruptions. Pretty good.
Do you like how it works that they keep replaying these to the fat point where someone gets sick of it? I've seen it four times.
Unaware of it. Don't even know.
Well, what do you think? And if people don't know, if the name Dan Clores is associated with the PR firm that you founded and you left it, you're done with the world of PR?
I've done for years. I sold it to the employees. They're doing great.
The model, which is you. We'll talk about the play you've written and you do documentary film. These are, hard financial lifts. Is that the only model? Make a lot of money somewhere else and then get into the world of documentaries? Or do you think that there's a possibility of some sustaining financial model for something like documentary films or off-Broadway plays?
Well, I think, I don't have much to do with the finances of it. This was funded by ESPN. But, it's hard. I mean, it's hard. My feeling is I'm there to help anyone I can. Because how difficult it is. And also, like Crazy Love, there was a theatrical release. Everyone said it was a great movie, except the New York Times. Commercially, it was a failure.
Yeah.
It's hard to hit big unless you're Michael Moore. He has the model, right? Ken Burns is not looking for the financial hit. He has the home at PBS. Everyone else is out there swinging their fists, man.
Yeah, but it does, as a fan of documentaries, if it's only going to exist as a labor of love, I mean, I say this as a public radio employee, it doesn't speak well for the future of the forum.
Well, you don't know, but it is a labor of love, but doesn't everything have to be?
Yeah. good if you could, you know, put some money in the bank.
I mean,
afterwards.
Except if you're doing a hedge fund or something.
Yeah, that would be weird if they love that, right? Yeah, I would worry about them. So are you working with the Knicks now, PR-wise?
No. No? No, not at all. Donnie's my pal. I don't work with anyone PR-wise, but Donnie's a friend. He was the assistant to Frank McGuire. I wrote a book on Frank McGuire years ago called Round Ball Culture, and that's how I met Donnie. And that book is not in print anymore.
Which were you from the same sections in New York?
No, he's from the Bronx. I'm from Brooklyn.
Okay, so
totally different
culture
sections.
Clash. Nothing to do. Yeah.
Irish Jewish man.
So the Knicks are trying. You know, their whole strategy now is to get rid of everyone on the payroll and try to lure some free agents in. Everyone can offer the same amount of money. You're a guy who knows a little bit about PR. Has Donnie asked you, what do we do to induce LeBron James to come here?
Well, he hasn't asked. I've offered my opinion.
Yeah. And what is it? What do you do?
Well, I think you've got to embrace him. You've got to make the entire city come out. I mean, don't think you could do silly things like make a LeBron James Knick uniform or
right.
bring him to Madison Square Garden and, you know, turn on the lights. I mean, it's got to be an all-out effort.
The guy doesn't need a key to the city.
And you know, it's not like these kids anymore. You know, they have their own airplanes. They don't need you to – the owner doesn't need to send his plane. I mean, they'll do that, of course. But look what you're selling here. You're selling the future. You're selling New York City. New York City is basketball. That's what you're selling. So, and the thing that Donnie's done great, look, they've been in the toilet for 11 years, this organization. He's finally cleared the space. You can argue, should have done this, should have done that, should have hired this, should have done that. Doesn't matter. Whether he builds it or not, the next guy is going to make it great if Donnie doesn't make it great.
But if they don't sign, they're talking about the class of free agents coming up is the best ever. If they don't sign, maybe not LeBron, but a couple big ones, is that a disaster of unmitigated proportions?
Well, my money's on Donnie Walsh. He did it. He's done it every step of his career. He knows the league better than anyone else. And that, to me, that's a safe bet.
We hope that LeBron James comes here to save the Knicks and, by association, save the mecca of basketball. Do you think that he cares about that would be a motivating force? Like, help New York? This is the place where basketball became huge in America?
I don't know. Everyone has a theory on LeBron James. I mean, who knows, man? You know, like, you know more about Herbert Hoover than you do with LeBron James.
I blame LeBron James for the Great Depression, actually. What about the Nets moving to Brooklyn, if and when it happens? Will that be a good thing for the city and the league?
Yeah, it's a great thing for the city. I mean, you got to give those guys credit. I mean, whether you're for it or against it, boy, they stood with it, you know. I mean, and obviously it's a play that's much more bigger than basketball, building the arena there. But it's going to be great for the city. I mean, I'm from Brooklyn. If Donnie stays in New York, I'm a Knick fan. If not, then I'll be a Net fan. And they'll build a team. They'll build a team. I think it's going to be great. I don't know what it's going to do for traffic, but it's going to be great.
Do you think nationally the idea of the Brooklyn Nets has some cachet? Because I know, you know, half the hip-hop albums you're listening to, they're talking about Brooklyn, but do people in Washington State or Oregon or Missouri care about that?
I think the one thing that people care about, right, is that you have to put a product on the floor that's entertaining, that's going to provide you with hope, that's ultimately going to win. You do that, fans will come.
My idea, by the way, to get LeBron is some city councilman should introduce the idea of just income tax amnesty. Like, you know, you write the bill very narrowly that everyone over 6'8 who is in a salary cap situation doesn't have to pay.
No, I disagree. I think anyone 5'10 from Brooklyn should get income tax amnesty.
Who's made four documentaries and is bearded. Yeah, I understand. So tell me about the play. You've written a new play.
I have a play coming out June 17th at Rattlestick, directed by John Gould Rubin. It's called Little Doc. We begin rehearsals May 11th. Takes place in Brooklyn, 1975. Can you fix broken relationships? Father, son, lovers, best friends. Four hippies who have seen their day, if you will.
And sports? Is there a sports theme?
Nah, there's no sports theme at all. It's about relationships. And, you know, I mean, one of the fathers happens to be a bookmaker, but that's about it.
Does that touch any aspect of your life, or you thought it was just a good dramatic device?
It touches most aspects of my life.
Yes?
Yeah. But it's an amalgam of others.
And what was, what was the name of the documentary you did about your high school friends?
Oh, that was my first film called The Boys of Second Street Park. which is guys growing up in the innocence of the 50s whack the counterculture and sex, drugs, war.
And then we see some of the same thing of the hippies and what that kind of havoc it wreaks.
You know, that's if you come from that, I guess that's what you're going to go back to.
It's your milieu.
That's right.
And finally, I want to ask you a general PR question. You know, obviously, whatever happens, Tiger Woods or some other big thing blows up, there's this new phenomenon of inviting PR, supposed PR experts on TV to do a play-by-play of what the PR of the situation was. That's every TV producer has this Rolodex of PR experts. Is there any usefulness there, or do you discount what most of these TV pundits say about other people doing PR?
There is probably zero usefulness of listening to any of these guys, just as there is less than 1% usefulness listening to any of these lawyers that are on TV. I mean, the talking head industry, I mean, if you are a person of real value, then why are you even doing that, man?
Yeah, I would think that's, or like, speaking of bookies, the guys that have to go public and give you what their picks are on a basketball game.
I mean, they, you know, there was only one thing for Tiger Woods to do, and that was to tell the truth from second one and say, I'll say nothing else.
That's it.
So you need a warmonger like Ari Fleischer to go on and tell him that.
We've been speaking with Dan Clores, who is the creator of the new documentary, Winning Time, Reggie Miller versus the Knicks. Thanks, Dan.